Good morning, and welcome to the last of the 2016 Legal Ethics Shiurim. There will be a break of a couple of months in the beginning of 2017. I think our next one is March, going on the basis of the theory that lawyers are looking for CBD credit the first couple of months of the year. So push it into March to start out. Our topic is Shabbos and the Jewish lawyer. Even though we're going to discuss issues which are actually very practical, I do want to stress that for specific situations, people should ask their rabbi and not just rely on what you hear in the shiur now. And I say that first because I'm going to be talking about general principles and not going to be going into certain specific implementation points, as you'll see, and I'll explain as we go into it. And also because I actually ended up preparing this last week, towards the end of last week, while dealing with both a back problem and the cold that you can hear in my voice. So this year is brought to you by the makers of Celebrex and extra strength Tylenol. But what it also means is that I am concerned about practical implementation of some of the things we're saying, and I want to really warn you that you should get advice from your rabbi. Please do make sure that you sign in, especially if you're expecting to file for credit. And I also want to thank, aside from the Celebrex and the Tylenol, I want to thank Alan and Risa Letwak, who are dedicating the shiur this morning in memory of Alan's parents, Mo and Rose Letwak. So this particular session, Shabbos and the Jewish Lawyer, is, you know, as you know, approved for 1.5 professionalism credits. Someone actually said to me on Shabbos, they said, you know, when I come to one of these, I'm always surprised I can get credit for this. So I feel the need to explain how is it that you get credit for a topic like this, and the answer is source number one. One of the rules of professional conduct, Rule 3.2-1, a lawyer has a duty to provide courteous, thorough, and prompt service to clients. The quality of service required of a lawyer is service that is competent, timely, conscientious, diligent, efficient, and civil. So you note there the word prompt and the word timely. Well, if somebody is Shabbat observant and something comes up either Friday afternoon or, you know, no one can expect a lawyer to work on Saturday, Sunday. So it comes up on the eve of Yom Tov. Pesach, Passover is going to be on April 21st, and now it's April 20th, and something needs to be filed. The lawyer says, well, I'm sorry, I'm Jewish and observant of Jewish law, and therefore I'm not going to be able to take care of this for you until after the holiday. How exactly does that fulfill prompt and timely? What possible avenues are available for a Shabbat observant, holiday observant Jewish lawyer to provide this prompt and timely service for clients? So that's the framework, and that's why this indeed qualifies for credit. So you'll see on the sheet, I gave you four questions that I hope to be able to address following on the Passover theme. The first two deal with the question of a Shabbat observant, and every time I say Shabbat observant, in your own head, substitute Shabbat and holiday observant. It's just longer than I want to say. But how can a Shabbat observant lawyer work with either assistants or partners who are not necessarily Shabbat observant, holiday observant, whether they are Jewish or not Jewish? And then the second two, we'll deal with a different sort of question altogether. Jeffrey gave you the challenge for this one. And that was, we know that when you practice medicine, there is a principle of pikuach nefesh, of saving lives, and saving lives overrides Shabbat. Can that ever apply to law? Could it be that what a lawyer does will in fact override Shabbat? And the answer is yes, actually. There are cases, and we'll talk about some of it in the second two cases. But let's start with the beginning, start with our first question. A patent appeal must be filed by April 21, which is the first day of Passover. On April 20, David realizes, David being the lawyer who's supposed to be filing it, that he will not finish before he leaves work. May David give the appeal to his assistant to file? What do you think?
Is his assistant Jewish?
First question, is the assistant Jewish or not Jewish? So let's play it out. Let's say the assistant is not Jewish. Is David able to give it to his non-Jewish assistant and say, I couldn't get this done in time. Please take care of this. The deadline is tomorrow.
Sharing prophets.
Let's say there's no sharing of prophets with assistants. In general, the way I formulated this was on the assumption, which may be correct or incorrect, you work for an accounting firm, so I don't know if you have lawyer clients, but I'm basing this model here on the idea that the assistant is not sharing in profits. The assistant is getting a salary, and you as a partner are getting from the firm as a whole. Whereas partners are sharing profits. That's the assumption that underlies this. So no, you're not getting any proceeds out of the assistant's work. So you have the non-Jewish assistant, and can you ask them, take care of this, please. Deadline's tomorrow.
We need more information.
Yeah.
Is it David's firm? Are there other... is he the sole owner?
Play it out either way.
Well, I think it would be really difficult if it's David's firm. He is the sole owner, doesn't have one, partners, etc.
Okay.
It's easy if it's not his firm. It's a big firm, and he's got a non-Jewish assistant, and there are many going and working there, and then I don't think there's a problem.
So he'll suggest, you know, if you can just put those back with the source sheets, that'll be perfect. Thanks. So Yechiel's suggestion is that it sounds like you're suggesting that it's really about benefit from his work, right? That's what you're pinning it on, and that's why you're identifying it as being specifically where it's his firm. Other suggestions?
No.
Nope, there's a whole other issue here. Okay, so let's move into the topic. So we'll deal first with a case where the assistant is not Jewish. So the first problem you run into is something called Amira La'akum. Amira La'akum means telling somebody who is not Jewish to do something on Shabbat or holidays that I am not allowed to do. In other words, it's Shabbat, and I'll take, there are any number of possible cases that you can invent, but I'll take an easy one. It's Shabbat, and there was a power outage, and my oven is off, and my stove is off, and I had left it on, properly covered and so on, to be able to heat food for a meal on Shabbat, and now it's not working, it's not on, and all my food is going to be cold. So would I be allowed to ask my non-Jewish neighbor to turn on my stove so that now I'll be able to have the food warmed up? So there are all sorts of nuances in that case. I'm not discussing that particular case. I'm bringing that as an example of the issue of speaking to a non-Jew and asking a non-Jew to do something for me on Shabbat that I am not allowed to do. And the general rule is that I am not allowed to ask a non-Jew to do something for me on Shabbat if I am not allowed to do it myself. That's the general principle. It's called Amira La'akum. If you take a look at Rashi, source number 2, he talks about the issue of telling somebody to do something for you on Shabbat, even if you give him the instruction, not on Shabbat day, but you actually give him the instruction beforehand. He's talking about the issue of carrying on Shabbat. There are prohibitions against transporting property through public domain on Shabbat. And he deals with a case in which a Jew finds himself stranded outside of town before Shabbat starts. He has a wallet with him, or a bag with him. And he knows once Shabbat starts, he isn't going to be allowed to carry it. And so the Talmud discusses whether he's allowed to tell a non-Jew, you know, do me a favor, take this bag home for me into Shabbat. And he writes the following in source number 2, "My time ashari le mesev lenachri." The Gemara there, the Talmud that he's commenting on, asks, why should you be allowed to give it to a non-Jew to carry? He is going to be your agent to carry it on Shabbos, and that is not allowed. I am not allowed to tell a non-Jew before Shabbos even to do something for me on Shabbos that is prohibited for me. Not only that, the prohibition is not only where is not only a concern for telling him to do it directly to do it on Shabbat, but even if I'm going to pay him for that time that he is doing it on Shabbat, I have a problem. In other words, separate from the issue of instructing him, if I hire him and I say, I'm paying you by the hour, and therefore, when you clock in and say, I worked on Saturday from 10 a.m. to noon, or I worked on, you know, April 21, which happened to have been Passover, I was working in the office from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., and therefore, you have to pay me X because I'm paid by the hour, that's going to be a problem as well. Take a look at source number 3 from the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in the Code of Jewish Law. He writes, V'imscharo l'chodesh, if you hire somebody even by the month, so you're not paying him by the day, but you hire him by the month, v'hizna l'shalin lo kol yom kach v'kach, but you say I'm paying you X amount per day, mikri schir yom, he is called a day laborer, a day hire, and that's a problem. So in other words, I am not allowed to tell a non-Jew to do things for me on Shabbat. I'm not allowed to pay him an hourly wage for doing things for me on Shabbat. And this will have nothing to do with the structure of the firm. It doesn't matter what my position is in the firm at all. I could even be another assistant within the firm, talking to an assistant and saying, you know, I couldn't finish this. Can you finish this on Shabbat? And I already will have a problem. That's one issue. All of that is under one issue, the issue of having a non-Jew do something for me on Shabbat. For those who just came in, please make sure that you sign in, aside from taking source sheets. There's a second issue. And the second issue is what's called Maris Ayin, the issue of appearances. I brought you a source in number 4. It's one of the classic sources on this from the Talmud Yerushalmi on Shkalim. In context, what it's talking about was the collection of the half shekel donation. Every Jew was supposed to give a half shekel donation to the temple. It was stored in a closet in the temple, and then they would take it out when they wanted to use it for the offerings or for various other communal purposes. So the Kohanim, the priests, were the ones who were responsible to get this money out of the closet and use it for whatever purpose. When they went into the closet, they were required to take all sorts of measures that would avoid any sort of suspicion that they had done something inappropriate, any sort of suspicion that they had taken any of the money for themselves. So, for example, they were required when they went into the room where the shkalim were, they were required not to wear clothing that had a hem, lest anybody allege that they had, you know, stashed some inside of their clothing. They couldn't wear shoes, lest someone say, well, it was in their shoes. They would talk to somebody throughout, lest someone say it was in their mouth. Like that, you know, you have to be careful. You're dealing with communal funds. You have to be above suspicion. And on that, if you take a look at source number 4. You find various verses that are quoted to support this idea from the three parts of Tanakh, of Scripture. In the interest of time, I'm just going to stick with the English, although the Hebrew is here on the sheet. But they quote one verse, V'yisem Nikiyim, you shall be innocent from God and from Israel. Another verse from the end of the book of Joshua, where there are 2.5 tribes who were accused of creating a separatist temple, a separate Beit HaMikdash. And they declare absolutely not, and God knows that we are innocent, emphasizing the importance of being innocent, not only in practice, but also in the eyes of others. And then the verse from Mishlei, from Proverbs, about finding favor and a reputation for good insight in the eyes of God and man. You have to make sure to maintain an innocent reputation, and there's a proactive obligation to take steps like that. Well, what if the client isn't going to know that it was your non-Jewish assistant who took care of it? He's going to think you did it. So now you have an issue of appearances as well. So, and again, I'm assuming that you're not billing this for your own time. It's not that. It's not an issue of your direct profit from the work that's being done. The issue is, I can't instruct a non-Jew to do things for me on Shabbat. I am not able to have the appearance that I did something on Shabbat. However, there are solutions for this problem. And the solutions require, number one, that the non-Jewish assistant act independently. And number two, it has to be well known that this is the arrangement. The parties involved have to know that this is what's being done, that it's not you doing the work. So in terms of having the assistant act independently. So what that means, in general, in the principle of Amira Lahakum, of not instructing non-Jews to do something for you on Shabbat, is that you have to hint at the act beforehand, rather than tell him directly. It requires that you hint. Let me give you an example of it. In source number 5, the Mishnah Berurah, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, describes describes a way to approach it. And he's actually saying something different. Actually, let me explain it before I read it. There are two different situations. He's dealing with one type, but there are two. One is the case of the lawyer, where it needs to be done, and you know before Shabbat that there's a problem, and there you hint at it before Shabbat. The other possibility is that it's on Shabbat itself, when the problem is recognized, and in that case you describe the problem and don't describe the solution at all, and just rely on him to figure it out. So take a look at number 5. His case, he says, when he hints to the non-Jew without an instruction, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan in the Mishnah Berurah, he says, you hint to him without an instruction, like saying, you know, the lamp isn't illuminating well, or I can't read by this lamp because of its charcoal, there's a charcoal buildup. And then the non-Jew hears and fixes it. So he says, that's permitted, that's not called instructing him. You didn't tell him to do this. And the basic theory behind this is that the prohibition involved is not, you may not benefit from his work. There is a separate issue of benefiting from his work in certain circumstances that doesn't apply to the cases we're dealing with here. But what he's saying is, the problem isn't he did something and you gained from it. The problem is that it's a specific prohibition against speech, against telling him to do this action. So as long as you didn't tell him to do the action, you identified a problem. He figured out how to take care of it and did it on his own initiative. So in that case, you're going to be fine. So if you had this paper that needed to be filed, you had the appeal that needed to be filed by a particular date, for you to say to him on the day before Passover, you know, I'm just not going to be able to file this in time. And then he says, oh, I'm going to be in the office anyway tomorrow. I'm going to take care of it. That actually would be legitimate. He would be able to do that on your behalf. The problem would be just not to give him a direct instruction yourself. That would be one way to deal with the problem. Clear? Second way to deal with the problem.
In other words, without specifically telling what's going to be followed by it, if you said, well, here's the document and here's the filing date, without telling him specifically when to file it.
So When you're giving the instruction before the date,
right,
you have more leeway in terms of how clear your hint can be.
Right, that's what I was suggesting.
Yeah, so maybe. It's an interesting possibility. I want to think it through, but I think it's a possibility. The other way to deal with this problem is something that is recommended in a case of need specifically. And that is what is called Amira da Amira. Amira da Amira literally means instruction of instruction. The story is, I'm not supposed to tell this person who isn't Jewish to do something for me on Shabbat. What if, instead of me telling him to do it, someone else tells him to do it? Someone who also isn't Jewish. So in other words, I go to my non-Jewish partner, and I say to him, Could you do me a favor? I'm stuck. This has to be filed before Shabbat. I can't tell my assistant. I don't know how you're going to do this with a straight face. But I can't tell my assistant to do this for me. However, if he's doing it for you, because you told him, then I'm okay. And believe it or not, it's a debate. It's hotly debated. I brought you, though, in source number 6, Mishnah Berurah quotes the debate, and he says, quotes Zebra Chaim, who said, yeah, if you have to avoid great loss, you could rely on those who are lenient in that debate. It's not something to use normally, but in a case of great need, it would indeed be a possibility. Because what you're dealing with fundamentally is a rabbinic prohibition that is specific to speech. That's the idea. Now, I do feel I need to clarify one point that I touched on before, even though it's tangential, which is when we're saying, I said before that this isn't about benefiting from his work; it's about not telling him to work. There are cases in which I'm actually not allowed to benefit from his work. So, for example, if I'm sitting in this room on Shabbat and the light is off, and a custodian comes into the room, sees that I'm sitting here with the light off and that I can't read in the current situation, and he flips the switch and leaves, then I also can't benefit from it. Even though I didn't tell him a thing. That's a completely separate prohibition, which doesn't apply in the legal cases that we're talking about for reasons that are beyond the scope of the class right now. So I just want to make sure to state it because I don't want to leave anybody with a misimpression. There's a separate issue of not benefiting from things that he does, but it applies to particular situations which aren't relevant to the legal work that we're discussing. But that's requirement number one, is that the instruction should not be given directly. The other piece of it is, I can give him a direct instruction if he could do it before or after Yom Tov, before or after the holiday. So let's say it's, again, April 20th, Passover is starting tonight. I can't finish this because I have to leave the office and go home. However, he has no need to go home. I'm not supposed to do work on the eve of Passover in the afternoon. He's allowed to go to work on the eve of Passover in the afternoon. So therefore, he could actually finish it today. He may say to himself, you know what? The boss just cut out early. I'm not sticking around. I'll come back tomorrow and take care of it. That's fine. He's allowed to do that. That's his decision. In the same way that I can go to the cleaners on Friday morning and give them a suit and say, I'd like to pick this up from you on Monday. They can do it on Friday. They can do it on Sunday. Or they can do it on Saturday. It's not my problem because it's their decision as to when they do it. I didn't say do this on. As long as there is enough time that they could take care of it realistically before or after, I have no concern. So that's a very important piece of the puzzle, is that I can give him a direct instruction if he has the opportunity to do it before or after. The other piece of it that you have to watch out for, though, is still the paying by the hour. You have to make sure that you aren't going to pay him for that specific time that he is at work on Shabbat. If you take a look at source number 7. Excuse me. Source number 7 from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law, and this is a source that's going to matter for several points. He says, one may arrange for a non-Jew to perform a task, meaning something you couldn't do on Shabbat, and one may set a price that you're going to pay him. And the non-Jew will do it for himself. He'll do it for himself, meaning he's doing it because he wants to get paid. Even though he does it on Shabbat, this is permitted, assuming you didn't say this has to be done that day. But this is only in private. But then he adds the issue of appearances. Because not everyone knows that this Shabbat work is for the Jew. But if it is known, then it is prohibited. For the observer doesn't know that there is a set price. He will say, this Jew hired the non-Jew to work on Shabbat. I actually need to provide a better explanation for that. This cold is taking more out of me than I realized. Okay. But I'll explain and then I'll summarize. He's making two different points here. One point that he's making here is to distinguish between two different types of work. We have in law a distinction between, in law and in accounting, a distinction between an employee and an independent contractor, right? We're familiar with the distinction, right? You have the person who is being paid to do a job in a certain way, at a certain time, and often in a certain location. And then you have the independent contractor who's told, do this job for me, but he can do it any way he wishes. He can use whatever time he wishes. I have no right as his employer to dictate that. I'm not really his employer. I have no right to dictate to him how he's going to do the job as long as he provides the end product, you know, at the time that he promised, in the place that he promised. Right? But that distinction is not, we're up on that distinction, right? It has all sorts of applications in tax law. No? Alan?
No, you're correct. But the context of this.
Yeah.
Somebody has an employee, and they're paid on a weekly basis, and they're given a bunch of work, and they say, you know, you decide when you get it done.
Correct.
As long as your work all gets done, and I'm paying you by the week, and you know, if you have to stay a little extra this day, that day, whatever it is, that's up to you.
Right.
But that Good. Person may not be an independent contractor for tax purposes, but isn't that person still within the realm of where you're going?
So that's what's coming next. You're one step ahead of me. So I do one step first, and then that. You are right, though. The first step is to say, if you hire somebody as an independent contractor, where he can do it whenever, wherever, then it's not a problem, and that's what the Code of Jewish Law is describing here. You're paying him by the job. You're not paying him based on time at all. And then the separate one is what Alan said, which is called havlaha, to absorb whatever he's being paid for this time with other time. If you're paying by the week, by the month, whatever it is, as long as you don't break it down into this is what you're paid for your work on each day, then also it's going to be fine. The other requirement, though, that he's including here is that it be known to people. It has to be, he says, if this is not done in private, if this is done where other people are able to see you, then you also have a concern because they don't necessarily know that it's being done in a proper way. In other words, if people can see it, then they have to also be aware of the arrangement that you're making. Unless, I'm going to give you one more caveat, and then I'm going to summarize this in a way that I expect will be more clear, but it's based on number 8. If it's a type of work that's generally done in a permissible way, then you specifically should do it in public, because then people won't suspect. If you do it in private, people think he has something to hide. And so that's the separate consideration. So now let me sum up what we're saying with a non-Jewish assistant and clarify, hopefully. Our concerns are you telling him to do it on Shabbat, you paying him to do it on Shabbat, or the appearance that one of those things is happening. Those are our concerns. Our solution for the problem is to say that, number one, you can't tell him, do this for me on Shabbat. If you're speaking to him before Shabbat, you're able to say to him, some kind of a hint, to give him a hint of the need, like saying, I'm not going to be able to file this in time. You can do that, and then he can understand what he is meant to do. There is also the possibility of asking a non-Jew to ask him in the case where you're absolutely stuck. And that will solve your problem of not telling him to do it. In terms of the payment, you pay him by the job or for a broader period of time. And then in terms of the issue of appearances, so either if it's the type of work that is normally done with an arrangement that would not be allowed, and you're doing it in a permissible way, so you just do it then you have to do it in a private way, in a way that people aren't going to be aware that this is going on, and that way you avoid the suspicion. However, if it's something that's normally done in a permissible way, then do it out in public. Let everybody see, and they'll understand that this is being done in a proper way, and there won't be any suspicion. I realize that was a lot, but is this somewhat clear?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Assuming the client's not Jewish, why not have the client instruct the assistant to file it? Client's the one that's paying.
Yeah. The client is not the one who's paying the assistant. The client's paying the firm, and the firm pays the assistant. But yes, the client could be the one to give that instruction. Yeah, that would fit this.
You said that some of this is specific to speech. What about written instructions?
Right. So written instructions are also a problem. Even though, you're right, I emphasize the action of speech, nonetheless, it would apply for written instructions as well. It's a good point. Thank you. Okay. So that was actually the most complicated part of everything we're going to discuss, this business of the non-Jewish assistant. With a Jewish assistant, it's actually much more clear, because the answer is no. We have a principle called Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol. You shall not put a stumbling block in front of the blind. And that includes putting anybody, Jewish or non-Jewish, in a position to do something that they're not supposed to do. So we have laws for all human beings, like don't kill, don't steal, and so on. You would not be allowed to put a non-Jew in position to violate one of his laws, and you're also not allowed to put a Jew in position to violate his laws. Now you'll say, what if he's not blind? Meaning, he knows perfectly well that there are laws of Shabbat. He's an adult. He's decided for himself that this is the way he wants to live his life. Is there any issue with giving him work to do? It's his own decision that he makes. Nonetheless, it is still prohibited. Take a look, please, at source number 10. Number 9 is also a good source for this, but number 10 is the one I'm going to use. Maimonides with his formulation. He writes regarding selling somebody tools that he could use and that he likely will use to commit a crime. So he says, God said, do not put a stumbling block before the blind. This means that if someone is blinded by lust or bad views, do not assist his blindness and mislead him further. Right? There are different types of blindness. And he says to assist somebody in wrongdoing, to set him up to do something wrong, is inappropriate even where he's not technically blind to the problem, but he has simply fooled himself or has, you know, tricked himself into doing something. So from a Jewish law perspective, granted that all human beings have free will and the ability to do whatever they want, but from the Jewish law perspective, they're going to say, well, the act that he's doing is because he doesn't see what we see. That's the way it's looked at. And therefore, you're not supposed to assist him in, you're not supposed to lead him into doing it. There's a second layer prohibition called misayeya, which is that I'm not allowed to assist somebody in wrongdoing. And so that also would be involved in this situation. So do you have any solutions, anything that you could do that will help you in this? There is only one side that is helpful in certain situations, and that's what I brought you in source number 11. This is the case on which Maimonides was commenting in number 10. He's dealing with in context, it's dealing with the laws of the sabbatical year. Every 7 years, the land in Israel is supposed to be left fallow. You're not supposed to plant it. Well, what if my business is the sale of farming equipment? And a Jew comes to me in the beginning of the sabbatical year and says, I'd like to buy a plow. So I know what he's going to do with the plow. Am I allowed to sell him the plow? So source number 11 gives you the rule. One may not sell tools which could only be used for sin. But one may sell tools which could be used for prohibited or permitted purposes. So, for example, if he wants to buy a tool that's used to process grain that's already been cut, so that could be fine. He could be processing grain that was cut before the sabbatical year. Or, in certain cases, there's even the argument that maybe he's buying it now for use after the sabbatical year because it's on sale. Right? If you own a business that sells farming equipment, it should all be on sale in the sabbatical year. So he's just stocking up now. And therefore, that argument may be made. This is what is called in Hebrew being tole, relying on an assumption that the person is not going to do something illicit, something that is inappropriate. So maybe you could be tole, maybe you could say, and that he's not going to. But that's really hard to do when you're talking about somebody who you know clocks in on Shabbat and holidays, and you just handed him something that needs to be filed by the next day. So in this case, no, I think you're pretty much stuck in that regard. Yes, Alan?
What does that mean being stuck? So you have to tell him, in terms of your employment, that you cannot work on Saturday, mm-hmm. You cannot work on Yom Kippur. And if you do, then it's bound for dismissal for argument. That would be in violation, I would assume,
of
the Employment Standards Act, as well as...
Right. No, I think what you would need to do, without violating various laws, would be to make sure that you have a mix of population on your staff, so that there will be people who are able to handle... It's making sure there's coverage. In the same way that when you have medical practice, right, well, this isn't always true in Canada, but it was true in the United States, where I come from. The medical practices, doctors made sure that they had multiple doctors on staff such that when one is off, there's still coverage with somebody else. They didn't say, hey, go to a walk-in clinic. They made sure that there was coverage for all days of the week. I think that's what you would be looking at doing. You'd make sure that you have a sufficiently diverse staff such that things like this can be taken care of. That's the way I would think you'd look at it. Yeah.
You have the possibility of assigning work far enough in advance that the Jewish staff member could, if they wanted to, complete their work before the holiday. I mean, it doesn't really come up for Shabbos except for the last hour. On
right.
Now.
And the answer, no, but the answer would be, in other words, let's give a practical case. It's Thursday morning. There's something that needs to be done in the next few days. Can I give it to him on Thursday morning? I think the answer is yes. You know, because he does have enough time to take care of it. Would I be happier giving it to someone in a situation where I know for sure there will be no violation of Shabbat? Absolutely. But if this is the option that's available to me, I think that's where being tole, we're relying on it, you know, on this, on the assumption that he has plenty of time, becomes more safe. Okay. So that's the issue where it's your assistant. What about where you are partners? Partners in the firm. In other words, it's not me giving someone something to do at all. I work for Torchiner and McConnell, and or Torchiner and Schwartz. And the firm is open 7 days a week, or it's not open 7 days a week. However, it's also open on Jewish holidays. It's not going to be closed for Passover. It's not going to be closed for Sukkot. So what happens in such a situation? So we divide it up between non-Jewish partners and Jewish partners. Let's say it's Torchiner and McConnell, and we're assuming McConnell is not Jewish. That's not always a safe assumption. But let's say that that's what we're talking about. Is that okay? Silence. Is it okay to have such an arrangement? I'm not instructing him to do anything on Shabbat.
Right, but isn't there an issue of the Jewish partner obtaining profits for working on Shabbat?
Yes. So here we get into the question of schar Shabbat, of profit from what's done on Shabbat, or benefiting from work that somebody does as your agent, in the sense that you're getting paid for the work that this person is doing. That's what we're now talking about. Take a look, please, at source number 12, a passage out of the Talmud. Story involving growers of saffron. There were saffron growers, and it was a partnership of Jews and non-Jews. The non-Jew took Shabbat, and the Jew took Sunday, so they had traded off between them. They came to Rava, a sage, who permitted this. He said, that's fine. That arrangement works. Ravida, another sage, challenged Rava. He says, what are you talking about? We've learned. If a Jew and a non-Jew receive a field as partners, the Jew may not say to the non-Jew, you take your portion on Shabbat and I will on Sunday, unless they set this condition from the start. Let me explain what he means there about setting the condition from the start, because it's a very critical principle. If you understand that, everything else becomes easy. The problem with exchanging my day as a Jew for a non-Jew's day is that what that really means is that when he works on Shabbat, he is my agent. When I work on Sunday, I am his agent. We're splitting the proceeds, right? I'm just the managing partner for him on Sunday, and he's the managing partner for me on Shabbat. That's the way it's looked at. However, if we make that arrangement from the very beginning of the business, such that we say, we're investing together, and I am going to run this business on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and you are going to run this business on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, that's the arrangement that we make from the beginning, then he's not taking my day. It was never my day in the first place. This is the way we invested in the beginning. He was buying into an operation in which he would be doing the work 4 out of every 7 days, and I would be doing the work 3 out of every 7 days. And you can arrange that with the holidays in a similar vein. But it has to be arranged that way from the start. Because if it's not arranged that way from the beginning, then he's just taking over for you on the days that you're not there, that really are your responsibility. And that's unacceptable. So the challenge here in this story with the saffron growers is that they have to set the condition from the beginning. And if they only make an accounting after they've begun, it is prohibited. So Rava was very upset, because it looks like he's made a mistake in this regard. But then it turned out that these saffron growers had set the condition from the beginning. No, it was all on the up and up. Everything was done fine. So we understand then from this that I'm not allowed to benefit from what he does. And even if he's doing it on his own initiative, even if it has nothing, in other words, let's say the case is that when we started our business, we didn't make any such arrangement. I just don't show up on those days. I don't show up on Shabbat. I don't show up on the holidays. And he's doing it himself. I'm still not allowed to benefit. If you take a look at number 13, talking about a bathhouse, the owner of a bathhouse. So someone has to show up to actually fire up the heat so that the water will be hot. Rabbi Kagan, in the Mishnah Berurah, in source number 13, says, paying by the job, where all proceeds go to the Jew, and the Jew pays a non-Jew a fixed annual sum for his work. So he's actually not dealing with a partnership case per se in this, but it's still relevant for us, as you'll see. Where you're paying him a fixed annual sum, so you're not paying him for the day of Shabbat, and you're not telling him go in on that day, is prohibited by law for a bathhouse, for the non-Jew is the Jew's agent, and the Jew benefits from Shabbat work. If the non-Jew wouldn't work that day, the Jew would lose that day's proceeds. In other words, even though you didn't tell him to show up, and even though he's being paid overall, he's not being paid to show up on that day, nonetheless, I'm not supposed to benefit from it. Now, there are different sources that explain why this is prohibited, and it's instructive to see the arguments. Take a look at number 14, please. Rabbi Yosef Karo quoted an earlier work called the Smag, Sefer Mitzvot Hagadol, in which he says it's because the Torah frames the prohibition against work on Shabbat by saying, Kol melacha lo ye'aseh bahem. No task shall be performed on those days. The wording is, no task shall be performed. So it's not just, you shall not perform, but it shall not be performed. And so he quotes a Midrash Halacha on this that says, not only are you not allowed to do it, but a non-Jew can't do it on your behalf either. You are not allowed to profit. Now Rabbi Karo hems and haws a little bit on whether this is actually a biblical prohibition or whether it's rabbinic. That has major ramifications. Because if it is rabbinic, there may be grounds for leniency in a case of need. Like with Amir al-Akum telling a non-Jew to do something for you on Shabbat, if it's rabbinically prohibited, there may be leniencies in a case of great need. So Rabbi Karo says this might be rabbinic. However, there are other explanations for the issue. Take a look at number 15, Rambam Maimonides. He actually says straight out that it's a rabbinic prohibition. He says it's not biblical. It's the concern that you start to take it lightly. If you can have a non-Jew do this for you, at some point, you might say, yeah, you know what, I can do it too. What's the difference, really? He's doing it for me, and it's allowed. I guess it's okay for me to do it. So he says that's really a rabbinic prohibition. A third explanation is brought by Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein in source number 16, in which he says that it's because the non-Jew is acting as your emissary, as your agent. If you take a look at what he says, in the previous sections we explained that a Jew may allow a non-Jew to perform a non-portable task for him. I'm not going to get into the portable and non-portable, it's not relevant for us. I'm going to actually jump to his second paragraph, because this is the key on the partnership. In the first paragraph, he concludes that partners in a business can't arrange for the non-Jew to work on Shabbat on behalf of the business. And he says, do not be amazed and ask, just because a non-Jew has a share in a business, the position is worse? How is it possible to suggest this? When the business is solely a Jewish property and the Jew hires a non-Jew for a job, the non-Jew does not function as the Jew's emissary. The non-Jew performs the task for his own good. The Jew's benefit is only incidental. If there are two partners in a business, though, both partners are responsible to take care of the work. Certainly, if the non-Jewish partner performs a task on his own on Shabbat, he will expect the Jew to perform it alone on one day during the week in exchange. This is exactly parallel to the case of a Jew who says to a non-Jew, work for me on Shabbat and I will work for you on Sunday. The non-Jew is truly the Jew's emissary. His argument is that if you have a partnership, even if you didn't tell him to do this, it's like you're telling him to do this, and he's doing it on your behalf. He is your agent naturally. These are three different arguments that are brought for why a Jew can't benefit from the non-Jew's work in the partnership that's done on Shabbat or holidays. Either because the Torah says no task shall be performed, or because it's a rabbinic decree lest they come to do it themselves, or unless the Jew do it himself, or because if he's your partner, he is acting on your behalf on Shabbat, whether you told him to or not. Yechiel, I saw you were...
I'm just figuring out how I can do any business.
Ah, so what in the world is that? Are we just going to drop it here? No, we're not going to drop it here. But this is a concern. There's also a concern called Schar Shabbat, being paid for things that are done on Shabbat. In other words, this is all benefit I received from Allah. It isn't about being paid. There's an addition prohibition specifically when it comes to payment. I'm not allowed to be paid for work that I do on Shabbat. Source number 17, source number 18. You can't pay somebody for work that's done on Shabbat, just as you can't be paid on for work done on Shabbat. And this is a separate prohibition against commerce. There's a biblical prohibition against writing on Shabbat. There's a rabbinic prohibition against engaging in commerce on Shabbat, lest you write things down. And based on that, I can't hire somebody to do something for me on Shabbat, lest you ask the classic question, then how is it that, you know, a rabbi could be a scholar in residence and get paid? How is it you could have a chazan, a person who reads from the Torah? The answer is, generally speaking, they're asked to do some work during the week as well, whether that's preparation, whether that's actually giving a talk, or whatever it is, and they're paid a lump sum, that's like the havla that we talked about before, and this rabbinic prohibition is only about being paid for Shabbat-specific things, or where somebody is being paid not for their work, but for not taking another job, which would have taken them away from this. That's more like a career educator type of a situation. But in terms of what we're talking about at hand, we have a serious problem. If I am not supposed to benefit from work done on Shabbat, even by someone who isn't Jewish, and I can't pay somebody to work on Shabbat either, what in the world do we do? So the solutions that we have essentially involve changing the arrangement. So first and simplest, well, I don't know if it's simplest. I shouldn't say that. It's not the simplest. But the first approach is that you create a partnership agreement from the beginning, just like we've already talked about. You create a partnership agreement from the beginning in which you exchange Shabbat holidays for other days. But like we said, it's before the agreement, before the partnership ever starts. It's what we saw already in the passage in the Talmud about the saffron growers, and it's found in number 19. If they set, this is from the Code of Jewish Law, if they set a condition from the start of their partnership for Shabbat proceeds to go to the non-Jew alone, whether there was a little or a lot, and the proceeds for another day of the week will go only to the Jew, this is permitted. If they did not set the condition at the start, then when they divide, oh, sorry, let me pause there, because he's going to go into the second solution. But the first solution is, don't join the partnership without making this arrangement to begin with. That's one way. What if you didn't? What if you're already a partner? Or what if that's just really impractical to actually set up an agreement like that? So they offer a second solution. I'm not really sure how practical this is either, but this is your second solution. If they did not set the condition at the start, so now I'm already in, I'm working, then when they divide up the proceeds, the non-Jew should take the proceeds of all Shabbatot, and they divide the rest evenly. So in other words, whatever was made on Shabbat, whatever was made on the holiday, I'm not taking any of it. It's yours. Now, you'll say, can you really do that? Can you sit down and make it an accounting like that? So, and if the proceeds of Shabbat are not known, the non-Jew should take 1/7 of the proceeds himself. Just take one, tell them, you get 14.28% or whatever it is, and then we'll divide up the rest. I don't want to have any profit from that which was done on Shabbat. That would be the agreement, which, again, you have to worry still about maritain, about appearances, and that requires then that this also be known to the players, which is a little tricky, I must admit. Not to mention, what if you realize from the start that you can't make such an arrangement, that it's impractical for you to actually make such an arrangement? So there's a debate as to whether you're allowed to do this or not. Moshe Feinstein, I brought in source number 21, was of the opinion that if you know that you can't actually split off and identify Shabbat proceeds, then this whole thing falls apart. But others, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg and others, disagree and say, no, you can just say, divide it up and give him the 1/7 that is the proceeds from Shabbat. I'm hesitant to ask the question of whether this actually works in practice. I think I'm not going to ask you the question of whether this actually works in practice to divide up proceeds in such a way. My understanding is that it's less of an issue because law firms tend to be closed on Saturdays, or at least that's what I've read. That you can answer for me. Are law firms generally closed on Saturdays?
Yes.
So that will diminish the problem involved.
But, now you're but can forward. People go in and work in bill hours?
Yeah.
Can people go
you
in on their
say
own?
You say closed, but your underlings are going in and working.
Interesting. So I have to think about that one. Yeah.
What if you pick up the voicemail from Shabbos on Sunday and then you do the work on Sunday?
Right.
Is the instructions from Saturday?
So I'm actually not going to touch on that one now. It's a good question. It's a whole other can of worms, so to speak, in terms of whether you're considered to be benefiting from what he told you. The answer in a nutshell is you're probably fine, but I'm not going to go into the whole thing behind it. There's more than we have time for. Jeffrey, you got a hand up? Lawyers work on the weekends. Okay. So, sorry, you were going to say?
I'm saying reception is visiting the office. The main entrance is open. The office is open.
Okay.
I just want to ask a question.
Yeah.
I don't want to look at a cute solution in the mouth, but why is it different if you make the arrangement right from the beginning? You said halakhically you're not allowed to take an arrangement of things. I'm going to work on Sunday, you're going to work on Shabbos. This way,
right.
That's prohibited. But if you do it right from the get-go, then it's fine.
Right. So the answer that I would give is that you're not exchanging it if it was never part of your responsibilities from the start. It was never your day to work. And you'll give up everything from that day. He'll take whatever profits come from that day too. It's not like I'm going to benefit from the deal. You're not benefiting from the deal. It's just that the arrangement from the beginning was Saturday was never. I never entered this partnership with the understanding of working on Saturday. Now, this is all with a non-Jewish partner. What about with our Jewish partners? Do I run afoul of the problem of lifnei iver, not to put a stumbling block in front of the blind? And the answer is probably not. And the reason why it's probably not an issue, I'm going to do it outside of the sources, but you can see them there on the sheet. But the reason why this is probably not an issue is because we generally say that the law of lifnei iver, not to put a stumbling block in front of the blind, doesn't apply if you would have stumbled without you. The classic discussion in the Talmud, which I brought you in number 22, talks about the case of a Nazirite. You have someone who has taken a vow saying he's not going to drink wine. That's his that's his vow. You hand him a cup of wine. So he didn't have any wine. You handed him wine. That's lifnei iver. You're putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. However, in the event that he had access to wine, the wine was there on the table, and you just picked it up, being a nice guy, and you gave it to him, it may be an inappropriate thing to do, but you didn't violate the law, because he had access to the table also. Similarly here, in the event that you did not join this partnership, that would not have led him to say, oh, well, I guess I'm going to become a Shabbat observant lawyer. He would have found another partner. It's not like there's a paucity of lawyers or potential partners out there. So as long as, in your absence, he could find another lawyer just as good as you, just as amenable, and even more amenable because he doesn't care about the Shabbat contract situation, and then, yeah, there's no issue of lifnei iver. You're not putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. Alan, you look perplexed. Oh, okay, good. Also, don't look at your solution in the mouth, to quote Michael. The other piece of it is the concern for Misayeya. Are you assisting him? However, there are various reasons why that is not a concern here. I brought you some of the sources on it, source 24, 25, 26. Number one, because it is argued that the concern for assisting doesn't apply if the concern for putting a stumbling block in front of him doesn't apply. If the biblical one of don't put a stumbling block doesn't apply, then the prohibition against assisting him also doesn't apply. Another argument for why it's not an issue is the prohibition against assistance doesn't apply if you're dealing with somebody who flouts the law. It isn't like the biblical prohibition against putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. The prohibition against assisting is a lower grade prohibition, and it only applies in assisting somebody to sin where he's somebody who really, you're not sure whether he would do it. If it's somebody who always does it, it's not a problem. There are more leniencies to this. I brought them on the sheet, but in the interest of time, I'm going to skip what I have there. So you have solutions for those problems. What about, though, the profit issue? And once again, he is going to be your agent for work on Shabbat. The same problem we have with the non-Jew, what are we going to do with the Jew? So here again, there's a great debate. Right? Moshe Feinstein is of the position that the agreement possibilities for a non-Jew do not apply for the Jew. Take a look at source number 27, please. He says the permission of a partnership with non-Jews should not be permitted for a Jew who violates Shabbat. The Shabbat observant Jew benefits from the Jew's work. That's why the Shabbat violator agrees for the Shabbat observant Jew to take one of the weekdays. He says, of course he's working for you. He's working on your behalf when he works on those days. Rabbi Feinstein was not okay. The agreements that we just talked about for the non-Jewish partners, he wasn't okay with for the Jew. However, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg and Rabbi Yaakov Breisch, I brought you Breisch in source number 28, disagreed. And they said, no, they said you are indeed allowed to make such an arrangement. And Rabbi Breisch talks about popular practice where he lived in Switzerland. He was a Holocaust survivor. He moved to Switzerland after the war. And he writes, here in Switzerland, the practice is that every doctor has one free weekday, aside from the national statutory day of rest. Those who are concerned for God's word choose the Holy Shabbat as their free day, such that their business is closed on Shabbat. Meaning, some other doctor is going to be taking that day. I'm taking it as a free day. Some other doctor is going to be taking it, including a Jewish doctor, as a possibility. And he's okay with that. That's the popular practice. In other words, what we're saying now, to summarize, is when you're dealing with a partnership, if you're dealing with a partnership with a non-Jew, as the case, then make your arrangement in advance to trade days. Or if you didn't do that, then simply say, I am not taking payment from the days of that are the holidays. I'm not taking payment for Shabbat. I'm not taking payment for holidays. If it's a Jewish partner, so we seem to be able to deal with the problem of lifnei iver misayeya, the problem that you are assisting him in this. You do still have the question of, can these arrangements work that we're talking about? Right, Moshe Feinstein said no. Others say yes. Here's an interesting question that occurs to me as I'm speaking, and I don't know the answer. I intend to look it up and follow up with you by email. So anybody who is not on the email list for the lawyers, make sure you signed in today. Let's say you have the following case. I'm imagining that it's difficult for the Jewish lawyer in this partnership to go to the partners and the accounting department and say, you know, would you please make sure that I don't get any proceeds from these days? I'm guessing that's complicated. Am I right? Yeah. Yes. And I'm guessing it'll be equally complicated to just say, you know, shave off 1/7 of the first proceeds and just don't hand me those. But I wonder, what if the Jew says, let me give it to tzedakah? What if the Jew says, I'm not going to benefit from what they did on Shabbat. I'm going to give it away. I'll give it to United Way. I'll give it to whatever. You know, separated from... And I'm not going to claim the tax receipt. I'll give it anonymous. You can find ways to not get the tax receipt. That's not hard.
I thought the person receiving it, if the money's been earned improperly, it can't be given for tzedakah or received as tzedakah.
So my question is it called earning it improperly if you're not benefiting from the Shabbat work from the get-go? And that's my question. I don't know. I'm just thinking about it now, and I want to look into it. Jeffrey and then Alan.
Good news and bad news.
Yes. Yeah. But it's in his tshuva. Okay. Jeremy pointed to me. There is a response from Rabbi Osher Weiss in his brand new third volume of Menchat Asher. So.
There we go.
It wasn't in the part that you scanned and sent me. So what Jeffrey suggested, and he showed me that piece from Rabbi Weiss, is that a limited liability partnership may have different rules. Because in a limited liability partnership, you put all the funds into one pool, and then everybody takes from that pool. It is not identifiable who earned this and, you know, which days it came from. So my problem is that the part you sent me was incomplete. I need to see what he's doing in the rest of it because I don't think it should work. Rabbi Weiss knows a lot more than I do, and if he says it works, I'm willing to accept that. But the rationale that he presented in the part that you scanned didn't wash. So I want to see the full thing and then come back to you with that. I can come back to that by email as well. Alan.
What I've heard from Don is basically a calculation which essentially determines that the value of the work on Saturday is equivalent to the value of the work on Sunday. And you don't have to go through this whole process.
Well, that's the question you're still going to run into is the problem that you are profiting from what he did. No?
But
how did that solve your problem?
Well, because basically it's all money is all being bought, basically, because it's all in the same pool. The equivalent of one is the same equivalent to the other. So although it's in theory, you may be profiting what he does and he's profiting what you do, it's one pool of funds that are essentially equivalent.
Right, but he's still acting as your emissary on Shabbat. It doesn't change that. That's my problem with the limited liability partnership. I don't see how that, and it's fairly clear in the response that I've looked at that they don't like it. I'm not saying that nobody says it, but what I've looked at, they haven't been fans of it, huh?
All my years, I've had to do a fair number of these arrangements.
Yeah.
Professional firms, and also for businesses that had to have some operations on Shabbos.
Yeah.
In the professional firms, what's been done, you're going to disagree with this, is you say you have a Jewish partner and a non-Jewish partner. Whatever profit there is from Shabbos, from your work, or whoever does it on Shabbos, is yours.
Yeah.
But we're going to take another day, whether it's Sunday or Christmas Day or whatever it is,
yeah.
And whatever profit from that is mine. So I'm not your agent for what
well, that's
I'm
that's what we're talking about doing. As long as you set that up in the beginning, that's exactly what we're talking about. Yeah,
but
no, what you're doing, I'm fine with.
But in those situations, they just arbitrarily, it's impossible.
Right.
So they just say, well, just assume.
Right. So that's taking the view that Rabbi Feinstein is not happy with, but others are. That, you know, that if it's impossible to calculate, Rabbi Feinstein says, then don't do it. But the others say, so then you just, you know, everybody's mochel, they all forgive, and that's it. Okay. I want to make sure to get to the latter part of this, and just to make sure that everybody is aware, again, it's 1.5 credits, that equals 90 minutes, so I'm holding you late. Yes?
It sounds like a benefit. It must be a financial benefit. But you don't file that patent on time. You might be willing to forego the financial, you know, the day's wages, but you're going to lose that client.
Right. Right. So what about intangible benefits? Benefits that are less concrete? The answer is you're probably fine with the intangible benefits. We say that even regarding work done directly on Shabbat. That intangible. So, for example, let me not give example. It'll take me a field, but I think you're fine in terms of the intangible benefits. The latter part of this is the more fun part of the conversation. Everything we've done until now, I think, is fairly dry, but this part is really interesting. And I thank Jeffrey for asking me this question, which is: can a lawyer classify his work as pikuach nefesh, as saving a life, such that it's justified on Shabbat? Now, saving a life does not mean my wife is going to kill me if we can't pay the bills, and therefore, I want to work on Shabbat. Or for women here who are lawyers, my husband is going to kill me. It's fine either way. It's not fine either way, but you know what I mean. So, what I'm going to suggest now is largely in the realm of what I would call theory, and I meant what I said. I said that you should ask your rabbi about particular situations. But let's take first an immigration case. If you take a look back at the questions I asked in the beginning, actually, the way I structured it on here, yeah, what you want is the fourth case, the fourth question before the third question. So James's case. James is stuck in Colombia, where a local drug cartel is pursuing him. He's trying to flee to Canada, but his visa application is held up. May his Jewish immigration lawyer, David, pursue the application on Shabbat? What would you say?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, right. So, yes, James is Jewish. Don't judge everybody based on their names. He's very offended. His name is actually Yirmiyahu Yonah. He got Shlishi on Shabbos, and then they whisked him out of the country. So Yechiel says there is precedent for this, going back to the Holocaust, about processing visas and getting people out of Germany or out of Poland or whatever. And there is indeed precedent for that. What I want to do is divide this up between two types of indirect saving of lives. There are two different ways in which saving a life could be considered indirect. One is indirect in the case where your action is only remotely connected to saving him. The other is where the threat to life is not immediate. So in both cases, your action is not like a doctor working on a patient where you say, well, the patient is dead if you don't give chest compressions, if you don't show up and intubate him or whatever it is. It's less direct, either because your action is remotely connected or because the threat to life is not immediate. And the question is, so is this considered justified as pikuach nefesh, as an act to save a life? Yep, maybe. Thank you. So, I actually looked to a fascinating article that appeared in volume 30 of the journal Truman several years back by Rabbi Avihud Schwartz, in which he dealt with media issues for the IDF, the Israel Defense Force, on Shabbat, and questions in which the role of the media can indirectly, and sometimes very indirectly, save lives. And so the question is, should they be operating on Shabbat? If you have a Jewish videographer, if you have a Jew who's involved in the chain of command, is he saving a life by acting on Shabbat? If you take a look at source 29, I'll give you an example. Now, I didn't end up translating these. I go back to my disclaimer in the beginning of the class, which is just, I was not in condition for this at the end of last week. I'm glad I got through the rest of it, but I just didn't have the time to be able to do a translation of these. But look at his case, and I'm going to read it and translate it. He says, here's another example, besides the examples he gave before that. He says, you have a Dover Tzahal, IDF spokesman, who is responsible for Magen al-Kochot al-Lochamin. He says part of the job of this person who's involved in the communications is to make sure. Sorry, I should have done the translation because I wouldn't have to be doing it now. He works on communications between the forces who are out in the field and the media. So the Mechama Lebanon Hashniya, the second Lebanon War. There was an armored unit that was in the field in Lebanon. They had embedded with their unit somebody from Arut Shtayim, one of the Israeli networks, and he was broadcasting pictures of their advance in the field on television. There's a unit that's responsible to watch what's out there in the media. They immediately informed the unit out in the field that their movements are being broadcast on network television. What it means is that people watching television or watching online are able to see exactly where they are. Which, of course, raises significantly the risk to the troops in the field. So the question is he allowed on Shabbat to notify the unit that it's being broadcast? It's indirect. It's entirely possible that no one is going to watch them on that and therefore be able to come attack them. On the other hand, it's also entirely possible that they are going to be vulnerable as a result of this. You follow the question? What would you say?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, the answer is everybody who deals with this seems to think that this is clearly permitted. Rabbi Avihud Schwartz does. Rabbi Usher Weiss has an unpublished response. Rabbi Arya Leibowitz had a shiur online on yutara.org called The Limits of Pikuach Nefesh, The Limits of Saving a Life, in which he quoted an unpublished response from Rabbi Usher Weiss on this point. And he gave all sorts of examples talmudically that show that this kind of indirect rescue is okay. Take a look at one. As in source number 30, there was a particular type of a haircut in Talmudic times which was associated with the worship of idols. The worshippers of the idols identified themselves by this haircut called kumi, and it was considered a pagan practice and therefore prohibited. However, the sages permitted certain Jews to use it so that they could get close to the government. It was part of becoming part of, operating diplomatically within their system. If you look like them, it will be a lot easier for you to be able to engage. Now, that is far more remote than what we're talking about here. Right here we're saying if enemy forces see this, they can attack you. There it's, if you become friendly with them, then maybe when there's a decree against the Jews, you will be able to prevent it. There are a lot of maybes in that conversation. And yet they allowed it, so the argument goes similarly here. There are other cases as well regarding this. So let's go to the second half. What about where the threat to life is not an immediate threat? Take a look at source number 31, where you get another case from this article from Rabbi Schwartz. He says, he says, one of the trademarks of terrorists is that they fire on IDF units from population centers. They'll go to a school, they'll go to a hospital, whatever it is, and they'll fire on Israeli forces from there. Kara, it happened. Shayuri rikatot leever Yisrael hitbatzeh mitoch binyan shatzal yadash nimtzim bo yiladim. So sure enough, there were rocket attacks, and they came from a building that was known to the IDF as being a building that often had kids in it. Dover tzal hitfitzit ha-idiyah b'rishatot ha-tikshoret. So the spokesman, the IDF spokesman, publicized the information through the media. Ubiikar b'tikshoret hazaran, especially foreign media, for everybody to see the film that they had of rockets being fired from, you know, this building, which often has kids in it. So they made sure to publicize them. Hamatarai talav sher letzal hashiv eish lemakarot hayirim mitochi diabur rashi tachen shiv ke'u gam ezrachim. The idea being that everybody should understand why they are now going to return fire to this building, knowing that there are civilians who could get hurt. It's a terrible calculation to have to make, and that's its own discussion of how do you make calculations like that. But that's the that's what they're talking about. So the question is, are you able to make that kind of an announcement on Shabbat to publicize the film? At the end of the day, it's not as though publicizing the film saves lives in any way you can identify. On the other hand, if everybody is aware from the get-go of why you're doing this, and they see the film, maybe that reduces the outcry against, and then maybe that enables you to operate in a freer way going forward, and that could potentially save lives. There are an awful lot of maybes in this.
And clearly, historically, this has been an impediment to the idea. So I would argue it has a very direct effect. They will not take action until they feel comfortable to take action. And if they don't feel comfortable taking action until they let everybody know, this is why we're doing this. So I think there's a very direct connection there.
That's one argument. You can make the other argument, you know, which is that in cases where they publicized it in advance and made sure everybody knew, they still got condemned.
Yeah, but at least it allows them to take action. The question is not whether they're going to be condemned or not. The question is, will the idea take action? And if you know you've got a commanding officer who's not going to take action on top, whatever
yeah.
it is, until he's secure, he feels he's done what he's supposed to do.
Right. And you can make this case a lot more complex and difficult by saying, what if it's 5 in the afternoon and Shabbat is going to end at 7 o'clock? So in 2 hours, everybody will see the video. Return fire now. In 2 hours, everybody will see the video. These cases are difficult. These cases are challenging, the question. So Rabbi Schwartz, in this article, put the question to a number of leading rabbis in Israel today. Rav Nachum Rabinovich of Malei Adumim, formerly of Toronto. So his answer was, deal with it on a case-by-case basis. He said, I can't give you a sweeping answer for any of this. It is possible the scenarios you are describing will qualify as pikuach nefesh, as life-saving, but he said it's impossible to say this definitively across the board. Rabbi Dov Lior, he argued that it would be sufficient to violate rabbinic prohibitions. He says, you could violate rabbinic prohibitions in order to do this, so ask someone who isn't Jewish to be the one to take care of it. Or Rabbi Yisrael Rosen of the Tzomet Institute in Israel said, we have all sorts of devices that we've come up which can reduce this sort of action on Shabbat to a rabbinic prohibition, and therefore that's what you should use. Rabbi Shlomo Levy, who I think was from the Kollel in Yeshiva HaRetzion in Gush, says it's permitted. He says the principle you're dealing with here is not the issue of saving lives in terms of the soldiers who are involved and whether they can fire back or not. This is the issue of eva, the issue of enmity in general. Meaning, it is prohibited for a Jew to act in a way that's going to cause anybody to hate us in such a way that they would want to kill us. That's in general prohibited. That's called eva. It's enmity. And we apply that in various circumstances. And so he argues that, yes, this is considered pikuach nefesh, it's considered saving lives in that sense, because of avoiding eva, because of avoiding enmity, and therefore it's justified. So you can see a range of views there. But now let's take it back to the lawyer who we're talking about. And this, as Yechiel said, becomes a lot more clear. In a case in which your involvement is indirect in the sense that you are not working on a body to save lives. However, you are going to enable this person to get out of a country where they want to kill him, right, where the drug cartel is after him. I think it becomes more clear that, yes, this is justified on Shabbat. Once again, I stress, you know, ask the rabbi for practical cases, but I think that there is justification. And if you can drop it down to rabbinic prohibition by having someone who isn't Jewish do it, yes, that's clearly what, you know, the root one should take. Last case. The case of question number 3. Bullet point 3. Sarah, age 6, has lost both her parents, car accident, whatever it was. Her family was Shabbat observant. The state wishes to give Sarah into the custody of a non-Jewish foster family. State, province, whatever. The implication being, Shabbat observance isn't going to be there. They won't raise her as an observant Jew. David, a Jewish, or not raise her, but foster for whatever period she's going to be in foster care. David, a Jewish family law practitioner, wants to intervene so that she will be placed with a Jewish Shabbat observant family. May David pursue this on Shabbat? What would you say?
Yes.
Even though you're not saving physical life now.
No, it's because nefesh. If there's nothing, you know, life is mortal, nefesh is eternal.
So Rabbi Breslov says, pikuach nefesh, saving a life, is worded as saving the spirit. Pidyon shavuyim, well, she's not a captive. I mean, so the concern for her being lost to the Jewish people. Okay, so in order to follow this, you have to go back to a passage in the Talmud in Yoma, where they talk about the justification in general for overriding Jewish law in order to save a life. They want to know, how do you know that this is true, that we know that we do, but how do you know? And they go through all sorts of sources. One argument that's brought and then rejected is the argument of Chalel Shabbat Achad Kedei Sheyishmor Shabbatot Harbeh. Violate one Shabbat in order to enable somebody to observe many Shabbatot. That argument is brought and would clearly seem to apply to our case. However, it's rejected there in the Talmud. Instead, the Talmud's conclusion is to go with a different argument, which is that the Torah says, V'chai b'hem, you shall live by the laws and not die by the laws. In which case here, we're not dealing with life and death. So, if I were to go with V'chai b'hem as my argument, you shall live by the law and not die, then I would say, well, you can't justify violating Shabbat to get Sarah out of that foster arrangement. However, if you take the argument that if you take the argument of Halal Shabbat Achat, violate Shabbat once to enable this person to fulfill many Shabbatot, then indeed that argument does hold water and will say that you would be justified in violating Shabbat. Now, even though the Talmud's conclusion there seems to reject the Halal Shabbat Achat argument, nonetheless, it is brought by authorities in a Jewish law in cases very much like our own. If you take a look at number 33, he's commenting on number 32, so I guess I should begin 32 first. Passage from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law. Misha Sholchu Lahu Shotziu Bito Mi Beito B'Shabbat. Person got a message that his daughter had been kidnapped on Shabbat, Lotzia Miklal Yisrael, to take her away from the Jewish people. They kidnapped her, and she's gone. And don't think that this is a crazy case, because unfortunately Jewish history is filled with them. Right? The case of Edgardo Mortara, formerly Edgardo Levy, is the most famous example of it, where he was kidnapped and raised as a priest. But this happened in Jewish history. So he finds out his daughter has been kidnapped. The mitzvah lasum laderech pa'amav lishtadel batzalata. So the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says, get going. He says, get on the road and go save her. That is your mitzvah. And he says, violate even biblical law to do it. And he says, if the guy doesn't want to, we force him to. You don't have a choice. This is your obligation, is go out and save her. So writing on that, Rabbi Avram Gambiner, the Magen Avram, in source number 33, says, why is this? Because of the principle of Chalel Shabbat Achat, Kedei Sheyishmor Shabbatot Harbei. Because of the principle of violating one Shabbat in order to enable somebody to observe multiple Shabbatot. Now, again, I'll say, you still want to use the less bad option. Having it on Jew, do it is fine. However, I would note the basic principle, which I didn't write in my notes, and I have to make sure to write it now. The basic principle, which is, when you're dealing with saving a life on Shabbat, and delay could damage the effectiveness of what you're doing, then you're not allowed to go looking for more lenient ways to violate Shabbat. You're not allowed to go ask someone who isn't Jewish. If someone, God forbid, if anyone has a situation in which somebody needs an ambulance, right, and they say, well, I'm going to ask my non-Jewish neighbor to go call the ambulance. No, do not pass go, do not collect $200. You call the ambulance yourself. You're not supposed to wait. It's only where you have the option, where you know, and you have to know with certainty that delay is not going to cause a problem. So then fine, then go get someone who isn't Jewish. But otherwise, you do it yourself. And the same thing is going to apply here. If you know that you can that you could absorb the delay, then fine. But otherwise, don't go looking for other options. There was a hand in the back, and then Gary, and then Yechiel. Yeah?
Is there anything to be made of the fact that the example of the Zohar is Beto like his daughter in his house?
Oh, no.
A family member, or?
No, he's actually quoting an earlier response from a specific case. That's why. Yeah, it's interesting. But you often see that in the Shulchan Aruch, where you have language that's that specific. It tends to be because he's quoting something that happened. Yeah, Gary.
I would have thought also that a consideration would be making sure that whoever is best equipped to do it. And would it not be arguable that in order to have the best possible representation to a body, that somebody who is more familiar with Shabbat and understands and can respond to questions and make come up
Well, you're assuming that the person who is involved in this is that familiar and is going to be able to...
Well, no. The choice is between somebody who's shown Shabbat is doing it or somebody who is not attending that body.
Sorry, I didn't follow what you were saying. Go back to the beginning of the question.
So
I think I misunderstood.
We're talking about a situation where a girl... There's going to be a proceeding on Shabbat, and the question is, can you go and represent it or have somebody else represent
it? Got it. Okay.
So is not the point to have the person who would be best equipped to answer or respond do it as opposed to somebody who may not be able to answer?
And the answer is yes. Just like in the case of a doctor, we wouldn't say, well, you could ask this fellow who's, he's not Jewish. He happens to also be a medical student. Or you can go to the Jewish doctor. You go to the Jewish doctor. You go to the...
Or is he versus the cardiologist?
Precisely. Precisely. Yechiel.
Yeah, a little story that's been related to this. In Lakewood last week,
a
lady was pregnant. Yeah. And it was my son. It was a young man. They got into the cars. No sheet, no nothing.
Right.
Divided up the area, they went out and looked for her. They didn't know if she was kidnapped or whatever. It turned out, unfortunately, that she'd gone off to the river. But they were told to just
correct.
Go.
And that's the halacha. That's the halacha. The Shulchan Aruch writes, the one who asks a shayla in such a case is considered a murderer. You don't ask. You just this is what you're supposed to do without hesitation. So again, in applying this to the law situations, I term this in the realm of the theoretical because you're dealing with cases that have such unique parameters. Each case that you're going to come up with is going to have its own nuances, and so it's less black and white than in a medical case. Medical cases are much simpler. You simply say to the doctor, if you think this person, or anybody, not just the doctor, if you think this person's health is in danger, go. Go treat, take care of it. The factors you need to look at here are how direct is the danger, and is my intervention necessary, and is there time for me to be able to take this to somebody else, or would that damage the ability for, would that in any way diminish the ability to help? Okay, so I'm going to call it with this. I'll stick around to answer questions, though. I recognize that I still have to get back to you on the question of whether the person is allowed to give it to tzedakah, is the person allowed to give the 1/7 to Stuttgart, the proceeds from their earnings. So God willing, I'll get back to you about that. Please make sure you signed in. Thank you very much.